yours? He shrugged. No, I didn't, I said, my voice rising. How can you say that?
Please, keep your voice down, he said softly.
I didn't play with your emotions, I said. I don't even know what you're talking about.
Well, his voice was clipped. Maybe you should discuss it with Armand Janvier.
Armand? I repeated really loudly. Then I had to look around to see if Hannah had heard me say his name. Luckily, she was nowhere in sight.
Oui, Armand.
The look in his eyes told me exactly how he felt about Armand, and we're not talking warm fuzzies.
He called me early this morning and told me to stay away from you.
My jaw dropped. He had no right to say that.
He told me that you two were, how did he put it, connected, and that I should leave you alone because you are too far above me.
He shook his head.
He's not a good person, Colette.
I know that, I said. I'm not the one who likes him.
What did he mean when he said connected?
Telling Jules that I might be a secret duchess seemed embarrassing. Like I was a little girl trying to play princess and taking the game too far. It's hard to explain. It's something to do with our families. His eyebrows pressed downward in confusion.
I don't think you should see him. You are too young to...
Too young? I asked, bristling. You think I'm too young? You didn't think so last night, when we were kissing. His cheeks turned red.
That is not what I'm saying. You have not dealt with people like Armand before. He has spent his whole life watching his father, who is one of the greatest financial criminals in France.
So he is trying to steal my money? I asked. Ha ha, too bad for him.
No, Jules sighed. It is about his philosophy that I am warning you. He sees people as objects to be used and manipulated for his own profit.
I wanted to shout. I'm a freaking duchess. I can handle myself. The thing was, I knew Armand was just using me. But if he was using me for something that benefited me as well as himself, didn't that sort of make it okay? There's nothing going on between me and Armand, I said. I swear.
Of course, I believe you.
Jules turned to me, his expression less severe.
I just need you to promise me you'll stay away from him.
I took a step back. Why are you telling me what to do?
For your own good.
I can decide what's good for me or not, I said. But thanks anyway. His mouth made a pinched-looking frown.
You obviously can't, Colette.
What does that mean?
Just look at your friends, he said. They're wrong for you, yet you cling to them.
Okay, now I was getting mad. To warn me about Armand was one thing, but to get angry at me for even knowing him? Then to order me to stay away from him, and then to criticize my friends? I don't feel the need to continue this conversation, I said. So I'm going to just go away now.
Way to zing him, Colette, Hannah would have said.
Except I didn't want to zing him. I just wanted things to be the way they were before. I wanted life to have a rewind button. I wanted Armand to mind his own stupid onions.
All right.
Jules sounded tired and disappointed. I wandered away in a fog. I'd been avoiding Hannah and Pilar as much as I could, pretending to be really drawn to the art and listening to what Jules was saying. But now that we were finishing up at the museum,
There was nothing left to pretend about. We were all going to lunch, and then to the Eiffel Tower. The thought of going there now, a glaring reminder of how perfect the previous night had been and how messed up everything had become, made me feel ill. But unless I could find an excuse to get out of it, I was stuck.
Colette, hang on a sec.
Audrey touched my sleeve as I started to walk past her. Her voice shook like she was about to cry.
I'm so sorry about yesterday. I feel terrible.
What? I said.
You didn't do anything.
Exactly. She turned her wide, miserable eyes down to stare at her shoes.
I should have warned you about the catacombs. I was going to, but then I didn't.
Well, Hannah didn't exactly make it easy for you. She was pretty rude. I think you were justified in staying away.
I hope I never start judging my actions by Hannah Nordstedt's standards, Audrey said. Anyway, I had to apologize. I know we're not really friends, but I'm scared of heights, and the thought of someone knowing that and letting me go to the top of the Eiffel Tower anyway.
I stared at her, remembering how she'd gone out of her way to show me the key symbol, and how she and Bryn had helped me in the conciergerie.
Wait, I said.
So you don't want to go to the Eiffel Tower? Do you have any other plans this afternoon?
No,
Audrey said.
Why? Do you?
I was thinking about walking and looking at the cemetery, and I'm positive Hannah and Peely won't want to go with me. Want to come?
Which cemetery? She asked.
The one that Jules said doesn't exist anymore. She looked confused.
Tell me the truth, Colette. Are you just inviting me because you can't go without a buddy?
For a second, I was speechless, even a little offended. Then I realized that I'd never done or said anything to earn Audrey's trust or to show her that I wasn't just using her. I promise, I said. I do need a buddy, but I think it would be kind of fun. Is that weird? She smiled.
No, it's not. I just had to be sure. Do you know how to get there?
Nope.
Are you going to check with Jules? She asked.
I hesitated and inspected the sleeve of my cardigan. Is there any chance you could ask him?
I would, but it's a long story.
Her right eyebrow went up, but she didn't say anything else. She disappeared for a minute and returned with a half sheet of paper covered in notes.
It's called Arancis. It was located in the block between Boulevard de Courcelle, Rue de Rocher, Rue de Monceau, and Rue de Miromesnil. It's not far from here. But you know it's not a cemetery anymore, right? He said the only thing left is a marker on one of the walls.
I know, I said, but I want to find it anyway. I basically ran past Hannah and Pilar, calling out that I was going somewhere to see something boring and that they should have fun without me. While I did that, Audrey was clearing our expedition with Madame Mitchell. No teacher has ever been able to say no to Audrey, and besides that, Madame Mitchell was eager to avoid two fainting episodes on a single trip. And then we were on our way. Chapter 16. We're here, Audrey said, looking up at a sign on the corner of a building that read Rue de Miromesnil. We slowly circled the block, but aside from some little shops and a lot of apartment buildings, we didn't see anything.
Wait, Audrey said.
Look. We were near the corner of Monceau and Rocher, and she was looking up at a small plaque on the wall.
1,119 people guillotined during the revolution were buried here, she translated. But where? I looked around. There was absolutely no sign, besides the actual sign, that the area had ever held 1,000-plus dead bodies. Just here, I guess. Audrey peered around us. Wow. Do you think any of those people have ever seen this? She was looking two doors down the block at a preschool, outside of which waited a couple dozen mothers. Fair question, I said. Maybe French people aren't afraid of death. Or they're not afraid of plaques. I laughed a little. Yeah, or that. Personally, I wasn't sure if I would be comfortable dropping my 4-year-old off on the side of a grisly burial ground. But who was I to judge? Even if, as Jules had said, the remains had been moved down to the catacombs, they couldn't have possibly gotten them all. I took a picture of the plaque, and then we kept walking, circling the block. Once again, I expected to see the ghost pop up, but there was no sign of her. Maybe she'd grown bored with me. I guess we'd better get back, Audrey said. We could find some place to grab a baguette along the way. I'd rather not, I said. She didn't answer, but I was starting to recognize the way she smiled into the distance when her feelings were hurt. I mean, I need to eat at the hotel, I said. I'm just... Why couldn't I come out and say I didn't have any money? Oh, right, she said. I wasn't thinking. Free food always tastes better anyway. We turned the corner onto Rue de Rocher and stopped. The sidewalk ahead of us was blocked off. The street was completely torn open. The roadwork was enclosed by orange mesh walls. But as we got closer, I could see excavators and trucks moving around inside, digging roughly at the ground. Piles of rubble surrounded the worksite. Nothing about the way the men worked seemed to show that this was a place where 1,000 bodies had been buried in a mass grave. Again, I wondered if there was a chance that something of the remains had been left behind. If so, it would be entirely feasible that those remains might have been unearthed by the construction. And not just any remains. The Queen's. There seemed to be a chill in the air that I hadn't felt that morning. A man walked by carrying a clipboard and wearing a hard hat.
Pardon, monsieur, I said.
He stopped, and I realized that I had absolutely no way to ask what I wanted to ask.
Parlez anglais? I asked.
He shook his head. I said, trying but failing to come up with the correct French words. Audrey looked at me oddly. What are you trying to say?
I just want to know how long they've been working here, I said.
Combien, she said to him, combien de jours travaillez-vous ici?
The man looked confused, but seemed to decide that there was no harm in answering. He spoke in slow French to Audrey, ignoring me completely. Then he gave us a quick, unfriendly smile and walked away.
A week, she said to me. They started on the 24th, the day before we got here. Why do you ask?
No reason, I said. Just curious. The evening was growing chilly, so we decided to take the metro instead of walking. The route maps might as well have been the technical specs for a rocket ship, for all the sense they made to me. But Audrey knew exactly which train we should take and where we should change to. I don't know how you can tell what goes where, I said. She shrugged. It's a lot like the subways in New York City. Once you learn to read the map, you can get anywhere. A flutter of excitement traveled through me as I pictured myself riding the subways around New York over the summer. Next time we were in a metro station, I would pay careful attention to prepare myself. I imagined my father's surprise the first time I'd say, "I can just take the subway, no big deal." As we emerged from the Saint-Michel metro station and began the short walk to the hotel, Audrey cleared her throat.
So, what's going on with you and Jules?
Nothing, I said automatically.
Are you sure?
There was a gentle, teasing tone to her voice. I don't want to talk about it. I felt my cheeks redden, and the memory of the painful exchange Jules and I had had earlier echoed miserably in my mind.
Okay, she said, sounding taken aback. I just wondered if...
Look, Audrey, I said, stopping and turning to her. I know we keep doing stuff together, but that doesn't mean we're BFFs or anything.
Oh.
She adjusted her glasses and looked away. We've had fun, but we're just too different. I mean, you're really nice, and I'm sure...
I get it, Colette.
There was none of the usual lightness in her voice. She sounded tired.
I'm sorry, I expected you to treat me like a human being. I should have known better.
I didn't know what to say to that, so I didn't say anything. Neither of us spoke all the way back to the hotel. I felt awful, and I was on the verge of apologizing, but as we stepped into the lobby, someone called out,
"Colette!"
Jules was waiting for me. I was caught off guard.
Oh, hi.
Audrey took the opportunity to slip away. Jules didn't smile.
We have to talk.
Okay, can I just...
Right now, he said. I need to speak to you right now.
Something prickled at the back of my neck.
Why? What's going on? If this is about before...
It's not, he said.
Jules took hold of my elbow and led me to the small sitting area where I'd talked with Armand a couple of nights earlier. My throat went dry.
What happened? I asked. Please, tell me.
He waited until I was sitting, and then he sat down. He reached over and took my hand, then let it go, then grabbed it again.
Please, I said, beginning to feel lightheaded with worry. Just say it.
Jules took a deep breath.
I don't know if you are aware, but there has been talk of a serial killer on the loose in Paris. There have been many murders all committed the same way.
Yes, yes, I cut him off. I knew all about the murders. You could hardly walk down the street without passing blaring headlines and photos of the glamorous victims. And it went beyond that, in a way. I felt as if the news of the murders was somehow following me.
There has been another death.
Jules swallowed.
Colette, it was Armand.
What? I said, my voice echoing through the lobby. What?
He was murdered in his flat early this morning. I'm so sorry. I know you and he were.
Jules spun his hands, looking for the right words.
You were...
I keep trying to tell you we weren't anything. Even though I was stunned, I could say that much.
Jules exhaled for what felt like 10 seconds. I felt itchy, like my whole body was being bitten by ants.
Are you serious, Jules? He's dead?
He was found this afternoon by his housekeeper.
Jules tapped on the screen of his phone and handed it to me. I couldn't read the headline on the French news website, but it was clear enough. I saw Armand's name and his picture. My hands were shaking so badly I was afraid I'd drop the phone, so I gave it back to Jules. And how did it... I mean, what was...
Like the others.
He glanced away.
His head...
The head. She is cut off. No way, I said. Oh my God. Oh my God. Does Hannah know? Jules blinked at me.
I'm not sure.
How am I going to tell her? She was the one who really liked him. It would destroy her. Or it would turn her into a raging beast who, desperate with grief, destroyed everything around her. Either way, destruction was imminent.
Could Pilar help you?
I don't know, I said. I don't think so.
Or your teacher?
I shook my head. She doesn't know we sneaked out and met a French boy. Jules looked uncomfortable. He put his hands in his pockets.
I suppose I could go with you.
I appreciated the offer, but I sincerely believed that his presence would make things worse. God forbid Hannah start wailing about how it should have been Jules. No, I said, standing up before I lost my nerve. I have to do it.
Do you want me to wait for you?
He stood up, too. You'd better not, I said. This could take a while.
5. Stéphanie Vauquelin-Cauchy leaned out the fourth floor window, cradling her camera in her hands, and held her breath. She snapped off a few exposures and then reviewed the pictures. Good! The second one was in focus. It would be a great don't picture for her street fashion blog, demonstrating the ugliness of too short pants. From the time she was a child, shopping with her mother at Le Bon Marché, Stéphanie had known she had an eye for fashion. It wasn't that she was particularly careful of what she wore. Mostly she stuck to jeans and simple sweaters with a pair of flats. But she always seemed to be able to spot the fashion missteps of the people around her. That, combined with her ability to make razor-sharp comments deriding those missteps, had made her the leading authority on fashion among the students at her school, and now brought readers thronging to her blog. Being able to come up with a precise statement to express the contemptible cluelessness of other people was a true gift. Stéphanie checked her watch. Her friends were supposed to be arriving soon so they could all get lunch together. She sat down at her computer and started typing, hoping that she might have time to finish a blog post before they showed up. Next to the keyboard, her cell phone buzzed with an incoming text. 5 minutes late. She was relieved. Now she would have time to get the short pants post up on the blog. She rubbed at a smudge on her arm, likely from leaning against the window frame, and turned back to the computer. What should she say? Perhaps something like, "Where's the flood?" Or maybe, "You know the economy is in trouble when they start selling pants by the centimeter." There was a sound behind her, but she ignored it, thinking it was the cat. Another sound. Still, she focused on the screen in front of her. And yet, another noise. "Va-t'en, chat!" she shouted, turning around in her chair. Stéphanie sat frozen, looking at the woman in her bedroom. She wore an exquisite ball gown, a powdered wig, and a scornful expression. How had she gotten in? Stéphanie blinked. "Bonjour?" The woman moved closer. Stéphanie stood up and backed toward the window. La fille de la famille Volcan, the woman whispered, her face a ghostly gray color. Above Stephanie's bed was a samurai sword that her father had smuggled into the country from Japan. The priceless object was mounted on a polished piece of wood, its sheath below it. As Stephanie tried to get as far from the woman as possible, she heard rattling. The sword was coming loose from its mount. The woman glared at her through eyes of icy blue hatred. Without stopping to think, Stephanie ran for the window and threw herself out of it, crashing down to the street three stories below.
Chapter 17. I knocked on the door of the suite, and Pilar came and opened it, eating from a tiny bag of cookies she'd bought from the minibar.
"You look like you just ran a marathon," she said.
I took the stairs. I leaned against the wall near the door to catch my breath.
"Hannah's in a terrible mood," Peely whispered. "Armand hasn't texted her back, and she's been texting him all day."
I nodded, gathered my courage, and rounded the corner. Hannah sat with her knees pulled up to her chest in the middle of the couch. The television was off, and the room was silent. Poor Peely had probably been stuck here like this since they got back from the Eiffel Tower. Bored and quiet. "Hey," I said. "You've been a busy little bunny today." Hannah sniffed, but didn't look up at me. She was searching for something on her phone. "Did you have fun with the loser brigade?" "Hannah, I don't apologize," she said. "Just be careful. You know what they say. If you roll in dog poo, when you get up, you're covered in dog poo." I wasn't sure I'd ever heard those particular words of wisdom. I sat down on the side chair. "I have to tell you something." My hands were sweating, and my heart thump, thump, thumped in my chest. I began to suspect that the news of Armand's death hadn't really sunk in for me yet, and if I didn't spit it out, I'd miss my chance to say it with any composure. Hannah peered at me, suspicious. "I don't know why you even want to. Armand's dead," I said. Hannah closed her mouth. Pilar wandered over and sat on the arm of the couch until Hannah turned to her and snapped, "Were you raised in a barn?" Peely popped up as if the couch were on fire. I pressed on. "I don't know many of the details except..." "You are so not funny, Colette." Hannah's eyes burned as she looked at me. "This is so not funny." "I know," I said. "It's not a joke." Even as I spoke, she was typing his name into her phone's web browser. I took a deep breath. "I guess his housekeeper..." Hannah's scream cut me off. Pilar and I exchanged alarmed looks and converged on the couch. But Hannah was up in a heartbeat, yelling and screeching and swearing. She knocked a lamp off an end table and threw the bowl of chocolates at the wall. She upset the umbrella stand and then started kicking the back of the side chair. There was a huge ripping sound as the fabric gave way, and finally Pilar pulled her away and back onto the couch. "I'll get some water," I said, standing and going to the mini fridge. Hannah curled into a ball, sobbing. Pilar took the bottle of water from me. "Here you go," she said, lightly rubbing Hannah's back. "Have a sip."
"No!"
Hannah yelled, jumping up again. But instead of racing around trying to pull the room apart, she zeroed in on me.
"How did you know? How did you know before me?
Jules told me, I said. I saw him in the lobby.
He couldn't come here and tell me himself, she cried. He couldn't be a man. He's such a boy, such a stupid little boy.
Then she collapsed, bawling her eyes out. Pilar and I spent the rest of the evening being battered and abused like a pair of flags left out in a blizzard. When Hannah finally cried herself to sleep on the couch, we were so exhausted that we didn't even change into our pajamas. We just flopped onto Peely's bed. Pilar dozed off almost immediately. But even in my bleary-eyed, bleary-brained haze, there was a spark of alertness that kept me awake for hours until I finally passed out. The woman on the settee looks up when she senses me approaching, and her smile is genuine. The man at her side stands to give me a seat, and I look into his golden eyes and feel a thrill of dread. Duchess, he murmurs before bowing and backing away to leave us alone.
Ah, ma très chère amie,
the woman says, extending her arm. Her fingers uncurl gracefully, and I kiss her hand and curtsy. She slides over and makes room for me on the sofa. It's hard to get comfortable, and it's hard to relax, knowing every move we make is being studied. There's no getting away from it, though. People will always be watching her, and tonight, many of them are watching me as well. She takes a moment to sit up even straighter, to toss her hair haughtily over her shoulder. She, at least, will not show that she is afraid. But she should be afraid. I lean closer. I want to get away from here and take the woman with me. There is something I'm desperate to tell her. But when I look around the room, I see eyes on me. Steely, burning gazes, heavy with meaning and warning. The faces that watch me are faces I know as well as I know my own. Thérèse, with her red curls. Laurent, with his chiseled jaw and jet black hair. They are like brothers and sisters to me, but I have never seen them look at me like this before. I sit back once again, the weight of my unspoken words crushing my chest like a vice. My friend turns to look at me.
Nous n'avons pas beaucoup de temps, she whispers.
She takes my hand and squeezes it. The gesture is full of love and trust and despair.
Ah, Véronique, ma chère, que faisons-nous?
Chapter 18.
Are you awake?
Hannah's voice, stuffy and hoarse, woke me. She stood in the doorway of Pilar's room, freshly showered, her hair wet and combed out. Her face was pink and puffy, and her pale eyes looked vividly bright beneath her swollen eyelids. I propped up on one elbow, confused. The name Véronique echoed in my head, and I needed to stop and think before I forgot what it meant. Already, I was forgetting.
What time is it?
I don't know. I glanced at the clock. It was 6:45 a.m. Pilar lay next to me, arms over her face, snoring lightly.
I'm hungry, Hannah said. I was going to order room service, but I thought it might be better to get some fresh air.
Peely's asleep, I said, but I'll come. I washed my face, brushed my teeth, and pulled my hair back into a sloppy bun.
Hannah was wearing a simple white t-shirt and a pair of jeans, with a $600 blue wool pea coat. She pulled on a hat knit from thick white yarn and a matching scarf. I was still wearing the clothes I'd slept in, but I grabbed my coat, scarf, and hat, and we descended the stairs together.
"You always take the stairs? Everywhere?" she asked.
"Yeah," I said.
"I can't believe I've never noticed."
She was silent for a few seconds, contemplating this. I was only half paying attention to her. In my mind, I was thinking, Veronique. And there was a question. Some question. I reached for it the way you reach for an itch in the center of your back.
Veronique, ma chère.
"What are we to do?" I said suddenly, the words slipping out of my mouth. Hannah thought I was talking to her. She tugged on my sleeve.
"I don't want to go to the hotel cafe. Is that all right?"
The shock of finding the phrase in my memory left me momentarily speechless. "Yeah, sure.
We can probably find something good to eat in one of the places around here."
"Definitely." She walked out ahead of me, not quite holding the door open behind her, but careful not to let it shut in my face. The shock of the cold morning stole the breath from my mouth for a moment. Hannah didn't react. She was in her own little universe.
"Which way?"
I shrugged and pointed to the left, toward the small hub of streets lined with tiny shops and restaurants. The cafes were all open, the buttery scent of pastries wafting out their doorways. Hannah stopped in front of one at random and gestured for me to go inside.
"Veronique, my dearest one, what are we to do?"
We got in line and ordered croissants. Hannah ordered a coffee, and I ordered a chocolat chaud, a steaming hot chocolate that came in a little pitcher along with an empty coffee cup. We sat at a table just outside of the door, and I poured the chocolate into the cup. Then we wrapped our cold hands around our warm drinks and watched the Parisians walk by. I nibbled on my croissant, which was hot and flaky.
"I can't believe he's really gone," Hannah said.
I didn't know what to say. I couldn't really believe it either, except that it was a fact.
"Do you think he..."
She cut herself off. Her pale skin had gone white.
"I mean, I hope he wasn't too scared."
That hadn't occurred to me. I guess I'd never thought of Armand as a person who could be scared. He was too cool, too smooth. But was there a moment when he knew he was doomed? I thought of his golden eyes wild with fear, and my heart skipped a beat. The realization that he was really, truly dead seeped a bit farther under my skin and made the sun seem one shade brighter.
"I wonder if he thought of me," Hannah said,
setting her coffee cup on the table and covering her face with her hands. "I would have been thinking about him." That was when I started to think that what Hannah had felt for Armand was something real. Maybe she was controlling. Maybe she could be snooty and snappy and snarly. But she was a human being with real feelings, and she was in pain. I didn't want to think ill of the dead, but it made the way Armand toyed with her even more offensive. And all for what? Just so he could tell his friends he'd made some American teenager fall in love with him, and the whole time he'd been pursuing someone else? Impossibly, that someone else was me. And though our relationship had been mostly based on the Order of the Key and Armand's crazy plan to restore us to our noble places in society, there was no point lying to myself. There had been something else behind his interest. Even if he'd mostly been interested in persuading me to help him, he'd still been intrigued by me. So then, why play with Hannah? The answer hit me like a brick to the head. Because Hannah could control me. Because when I went back to Ohio, Hannah would be right there, urging me to pursue my rightful title as a duchess. If she let it slide, I would have let it slide too. It would have been a cool little blip in my life, something I'd eventually tell my grandchildren. But with Hannah's influence, I couldn't let it go, not without massively angering her and losing my social footing. I was the puppet. Hannah was the strings. And Armand had been making us dance. When we got back to the penthouse, Pilar was sitting on the sofa and watching an English language news channel. The anchorwoman sat up straight and put on her serious face.
Shocking new developments in the Parisian serial killings. Authorities have confirmed that a woman who survived a murder attempt appears to have been targeted by the same killer responsible for several other deaths in the city this week.
I looked up, and Hannah was staring at the screen too. Next to her, a graphic popped up, the photograph of a college-aged girl.
The young woman, a third-year student at the International Fashion Institute in Paris, is in stable condition at St. Marina Hospital after being attacked by an unknown assailant in her apartment. She reported to police that the assailant was waiting for her in her home, and only by jumping 6 meters to the ground from an open window was she able to avoid the terrible fate experienced by the other victims. Police say the girl is very fortunate not to have suffered any serious injuries, though she is being kept under observation due to severe shock.
They cut to a shaky phone video of a girl being loaded into an ambulance. She was young and very pretty, but what drew my eye was her forearm. On the skin between her elbow and wrist, I could clearly see a dark, elongated smudge. Just like the one on Armand's arm. The one that, because I could see it, meant we were connected.
The victim has been identified as Stephanie Vauclin Cochet, the newscaster said.
I sat back.
Vauclin.
The name was familiar, because it had been on the list, the one I'd seen on the plaque. It was completely, totally not okay for not one but two of the murder victims to be associated with a 230-year-old club of which I was apparently a member. When the report was done, Hannah looked disgusted.
They didn't even mention him, and he was the most important one.
I looked at the clock. It was almost time to meet our group in the lobby, but I had other plans.
Are you going out with a class today? I asked.
Hannah gave me an, "Are you serious, Claire?" I think I will, I said. Is that all right? I knew she'd never come right out and say it wasn't, so after she nodded stiffly at me, I hurried through my shower and threw on a simple outfit. Plaid, wide-leg pants, and a white sweater. I tied a scarf around my wet hair and grabbed my bag.
So we're skipping the party tonight, too? I asked.
Hannah looked straight at me.
Of course not, she said. Armand would have wanted me to go.
Oh, I said.
Okay. The car's coming at 6:30, she said. We're picking up our dresses at 3. But what are you going to wear? You never went back to the rental shop. You really need to have a costume.
I'll find something.
I mean it.
Me too, I said, my voice rising in annoyance. Hannah looked at me darkly.
Well, I guess I'll see you guys later, I said. I'll tell Madame Mitchell you're not coming, if you want me to.
That would be good, Peely said, staring glumly at the TV. Hannah didn't even toss me a tiny scrap of attention. I was on thin ice, and I knew it, but I left anyway. I called Madame Mitchell from the lobby phone and told her the three of us weren't feeling well. She must have thought I was the dumbest person alive, thinking she'd fall for it, but as I suspected, she didn't really care. Plus, she probably figured that if I was going to sneak around behind her back, I'd be trying to sneak around with Jules, who would be approximately 15 feet from her all day. About a half mile from the hotel, I found an internet cafe and sat down at an open station to search for information on the murder victims. The whole time I'd been in Paris, I'd figured that a bunch of dead people had nothing to do with me. Now it was starting to look like my week in France was all about dead people. News of the killings had made worldwide headlines, so it was easy to find articles in English. And as I read, the blood in my veins turned iced tea on a hot August day freezing. Gabrielle Roux, Pierre Beauclair, Rochelle Dubois, Armand Janvier, and Stephanie's middle name was Vauclin. Every last name was from L'Ordre de la Clé. Every victim was young and glamorous. Gabrielle had been a model. Pierre's photo was taken from a movie premiere where he had his arm draped around an American starlet. Stephanie was beautiful too, in the photo of her that the news website had found from her street fashion blog. And, of course, there was Armand, the most striking boy I'd ever seen. They were all the kind of people that, from a distance, look sparkling and fascinating and worthy of being envied and emulated. But up closer, I wondered if the shiny exteriors were just that, shiny shells concealing not-so-awesome personalities. Pierre Beauclair seemed to have spent the past few years narrowly avoiding facing charges for crimes ranging from drug possession to beating up a bartender. During the last few years of his life, the French tabloids had gleefully followed his exploits, plastering words like malfaisant over his photos in gleeful red type. Stephanie was your classic label-obsessed mean girl. Her fashion blog featured three times as many snarky examples of hapless fashion don'ts as inspirational do's. Gabrielle Roux had achieved a small degree of notoriety for throwing a screaming fit in the middle of a nightclub. As for Armand, my heart hurt as I searched for news articles about him. I didn't want to find accounts of his bad boy exploits, tossing innocent deckhands off yachts, yelling at old ladies, or whatever being brought up rich and overindulged made you do. Fortunately, all I found was a website for a movie he was trying to produce, a documentary about France's noblesse ancienne. Finally, I forced myself to stop searching for information on the victims. All I was doing was distracting myself from the fact that these murders had something to do with the Order of the Key, and that meant they had something to do with me. I looked up the address of the Hôpital Saint-Marina, and then found my way there, first taking the metro, and then cutting through a manicured city park to get to the brick and glass building. Buoyed by the fact that I'd successfully navigated the subway, I walked with confidence past the reception desk, pausing in front of the elevator to look at the directory. On the third floor was a department called Traumatologie, which sounded like trauma, which seemed like a pretty good fit for what Stephanie had been through. There was only one problem. The stairwell was off limits. I'd come across enough alarm will sound if door is opened signs in my life to know one when I saw it, even in French. I turned back to the elevator. The doors opened and a bunch of people poured out. None of them seemed freaked out, as if there had been strange noises or unexplainable shaking or anything else that might indicate that getting on the elevator would actually physically kill me, which was what my gut was telling me would happen. Three times I watched the doors open and the exchange of people happen, and three times I let the doors close again. You have to do this. When the doors parted for the fourth time, I held my breath and rushed in. In the almost 10 years since I'd been inside an elevator, I'd forgotten basic elevator etiquette, such as which direction was I supposed to face, toward the door or away from the door? And was I supposed to press the number myself, or ask the person closest to the numbers to press it for me? Luckily, One of the other people hit the 3 button without being asked, and I faced the door, like everybody else. It was a pretty large elevator, as they go, big enough to roll a bed into if you needed to get a patient to another floor. But still, the saliva evaporated out of my mouth, and the tears dried out of my tear ducts, leaving me gasping slightly and completely scratchy-eyed. When the doors opened on the 3rd floor, I waited my turn, fighting the urge to push past a pair of elderly nuns and run out. It was easy to find Stephanie once I was on her floor. There was a policeman stationed outside a closed door, as well as a cluster of people I guessed were reporters. I didn't know what else to do, so I pretended to know exactly where I was going and walked into the center of it all.
"Mademoiselle,"
one of the police officers said, putting a hand on my shoulder. Then he said something in rapid French. I put on my best, innocent face.
"Je suis une amie de Stephanie."
He didn't answer. He just stared. But the idea was pretty clear. No way, no how was I going to be allowed to see Mademoiselle Cochet. I held my hands to my heart.
"Très, très bon ami."
He frowned.
"S'il vous plaît," I said. "C'est très important. C'est de la clé."
"The key?"
His eyes narrowed.
"What about the key?"
"Oh," I said. "You speak English?"
"I never said I did not," he said. "What is this about the key?"
Whoops. Naturally, if the police were looking for an intruder who seemed to be able to pass easily through locked doors, information about a key would be interesting to them. Time to backtrack.
"It's not a real key," I said. "But she'll know what I mean. Please, just ask her."
He opened the door and went inside. A moment later, he was back. There was a new, different expression on his face. Where there had been contempt, there was now curiosity. His eyes studied me.
"She will see you."
He held the door open, and I went in. Stephanie was propped up against the raised back of the bed and a few pillows. Her right leg was in a giant cast, and she had a bandage on her cheek. I instantly recognized her from the photos I'd seen online. She was quite lovely, with a sandy-colored pixie-style haircut and delicate features to match. Wide brown eyes, small lips, and chiseled cheekbones. Even her ears were petite. She stared at me, trembling uncontrollably. One hand grabbed the bar on the far side of the bed, as if she was trying to hold herself still, but it wasn't working. There was an older woman sitting in a chair in the corner, crocheting. Stephanie spoke to her in French, and the woman got up and left without a word. Then Stephanie turned to me.
"Who are you? How do you know about the key?"
"My name is Colette Eislin." I started to step closer, and she flinched. So I stayed where I was and pointed to the dark smudge on her arm.
"I can see it." "You can? Truly? No one else can?"
She held the arm close, as if hiding it from me.
"What does it mean?"
She seemed so fragile. I was afraid that explaining my suspicions about Leclay might send her over the edge, so I decided to start asking questions.
"Can you tell me about the person who attacked you?" I said. "What did they want?" "They wanted nothing," she said. "Only to kill, to destroy." "Who was it?" I asked.
She closed her eyes and moved her head quickly back and forth, back and forth.
"I can't say. You will not believe me."
"I will," I said. "I promise."
"No, no, no."
Stephanie buried her face in her hands. I decided to share what I knew. Back in the time of Marie Antoinette, our families were a part of a secret society. It was called the Order of the Key, L'Ordre de la Clé.
Everyone who's been attacked has been from one of the families. I think whoever's doing this is trying to kill us off because we didn't die during the revolution. Stephanie stared at me.
We, she whispered. You're right. She is trying to kill us.
She? I asked. It was a woman? Do you know who it is? We need to tell the police.
The police? They can't help us. No one can help us.
Now her eyes glinted. She knew something I didn't, and because she was so frightened, she wanted to frighten me too.
Yes, she is a woman. She came for me, and she will come for you too. She will wait until you are alone, and she will wait until you are awake, because she wants to taste your fear. And then she will attack you, and you will not be able to escape.
Who? My stomach turned sour. Who is she? Stephanie let out a crazed, high-pitched laugh, a cross between a giggle and a cackle, and sat up straighter in her bed.
You know who I mean,
she said softly, staring at me. I did.
Oh, fantôme, she whispered. Of course you know. If you can see this mark, then you know. And you also know that she will be coming for you soon enough.
Chapter 19. I left the room with the cold, crazed sound of Stephanie's mindless laughter bouncing around inside my head. The rest of me felt like a shell, hollowed out and still and silent. I got on the elevator without thinking and rode it to the first floor. She couldn't really mean that the killer was a ghost? Marie Antoinette's ghost? It made sense, in a twisted way. Marie Antoinette herself had been beheaded. Now she was bringing that same fate to people today. But why? How?
She always waits until you are alone.
Alone how? Alone in a crowd, the way I was alone now while I walked back across the park? Alone on the metro platform waiting for the train? If I, say, stopped to use the restroom somewhere, would she pop into view and chop off my head?